Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, today we will take for a study sutta number 65. This is called the Badali Sutta. And in the last few classes, in the suttas that we studied, the subjects were monks who are living in harmony. That's in the case of sutta number 31, the shorter discourse in Gosinga. And in discourse number 32, which we took last time, we dealt with a number of the eminent great disciples of the Buddha, the great monastic disciples. And so one might get the picture that in the life in the Sangha, everything was cozy and harmonious, and that all of the monks who were disciples of the Buddha achieved levels of high attainment, of great eminence. But also, if we look into some of the suttas, and especially the Vinaya, that's the book of the discipline, we see that the Buddha also had trouble with sometimes rebellious disciples, resistant disciples who resisted the training, those who misbehaved, those who quarreled and fought with one another. And towards the end of his career, his cousin, a monk named Devadatta, actually tried to assassinate the Buddha several times in order to establish himself as the head of the Sangha. And so this sutta deals with not a monk of terrible behavior, but of one who refused to follow the training that was being laid down by the Buddha. And we see how the Buddha handled this monk. Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha makes an announcement. He says, "Bhikkhus, I eat at a single session," that is, he eats once a day, one meal a day, "and by doing so I am free from illness and affliction, and I enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding." Then he says to the monks, "You too eat at a single session, and by doing so you will be free from illness and affliction, and you will enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding." Now, one of the rules that comes down in the monastic code, the code of discipline, is a rule not to eat at what is called vikala, which is translated the improper time. And this doesn't mean improper time for everybody in general, but it means the improper time for ordained monastics. And that is from midday, which is usually 12 noon, until the coming of dawn of the next morning. But this rule was not laid down from a very early point within the Buddha's teaching. And so during an earlier period of the Buddha's teaching, before this rule was laid down, monks would be able to eat at any time that they wanted. But it seems that it was the Buddha's own practice to eat one meal a day. And perhaps this was an established practice amongst the ascetics in this period in Indian history. That I'm not sure about. But this had become the Buddha's own practice. And then at a certain point, he laid down a training rule which makes it a breach or a transgression of the training to eat outside the prescribed time, to eat solid food or substantial liquids. Now here, I have to say, it's not quite clear whether the Buddha is laying down the training rule, because in the Vinaya Pitaka, the Buddha lays down the training rule against eating outside the proper time because of a particular incident which took place. But here it just seems like the Buddha is making a recommendation to the monks. And saying that because he eats at a single session, so he suggests to the monks that they eat at a single session. Okay, and when the Buddha made this announcement, then this monk named Badali, who's not known any place else in the canon apart from this sutta, so this monk Badali tells the Buddha that he's not ready to accept this advice from the Buddha. He says, I am not willing to eat at a single session. And he says, for if I were to do so, I might have worry and anxiety about it. The meaning of this is not quite clear, but it might be that he was a type of person who was constantly worried or anxious about his health, and afraid that in order to maintain his health, he has to eat repeatedly in the course of the day. This is just my own guess as to the explanation. Okay, and so the Buddha tells him, in that case, you can eat one part where you are invited and bring away one part to eat later. And by eating in this way, you will be able to maintain yourself. Again, this is a little obscure because, first of all, one would think that if the monks are invited for a meal, the way it's usually done in Asian countries, the meal is served usually about 11 or 11:30, just a little bit before midday. So if he receives the food at that time and takes it away, then he wouldn't have any time to eat it during the rest of the day, since he wouldn't be able to eat after 12 o'clock. And also, it's not the case that monks are invited to houses to eat every day. Actually, that comes only once in a while. So probably most of the time he would be going on alms round with the bowl from house to house and collecting the food. So perhaps if he goes early in the morning, you know, about 8:30, 9 o'clock in our time, or even earlier, actually going right after sun up, maybe 6 o'clock, 6:30, 7 o'clock, collects the food, he can have some for breakfast, and then keep the rest until 11 or 11:30, and then eat the remainder for lunch. So it could be that the Buddha is making this recommendation here. But still, Badali has this inner rebelliousness, and he says, I'm not willing to eat in that way either. For if I were to do so, I might also have worry and anxiety about it. Okay, so the Buddha allowed monks to eat between dawn and 12 noon. And maybe for some who are not accustomed to that practice, it might seem extremely difficult, extremely austere. But once one gets used to that practice, especially if one takes two meals a day, a breakfast, and then a substantial meal before 12 noon, one finds that it's generally quite easy to maintain oneself through the day. If one eats the substantial meal just before midday, then the food that one takes will digest throughout the course of the day, and then one won't get hungry in the evening. And between sun rise and midday, one can eat as much as one needs to sustain oneself. I remember when I was in Sri Lanka, there was one monk, they used to call him Butt Bus, which means big sack of rice. He had an enormous appetite. And so when there used to be, they would bring a bucket of rice to fill, to feed the monks. And for each monk, they would dish out usually 2 or 3 spoons of rice. And by the time that's finished, maybe half of the bucket will be left. And Butt Bus will take the other half of the bucket. But he died young. I think from heart failure, because he put on so much weight that it's become almost difficult for him to move. But he would continue to eat half a bucket of rice at the meal till he died from, I think, from heart failure. But the true point of the Buddha's advice is not to confine one's meals to a particular time and then stuff oneself beyond the capacity of a normal stomach, but to eat in moderation, eat enough to keep oneself strong and healthy, but not too much so that one becomes stuffed, overfull, and then becomes drowsy and sleepy in the rest of the day. Okay, here the text says, when this training precept or training rule was being made known by the Blessed One. So from this statement, it seems that here the Buddha is actually laying down the training rule not to eat after midday. So when this training precept was being made known by the Blessed One, the Venerable Badali publicly declared in the Sangha of Bhikkhus, in the whole community, his unwillingness to undertake the training. And after he made that announcement, then it says that the Venerable Badali did not present himself to the Blessed One, to the Buddha, for the whole of that 3-month period. This was the 3-month period of what's called the rains retreat, when it rains heavily in India. And for that reason, the monks cannot go traveling, and so they have to stay in a fixed place during this 3-month period. And because Badali had refused to accept this training rule from the Buddha, then he didn't want them to meet the Buddha again, because he was very embarrassed by his unwillingness to undertake the training. And so whenever the Buddha was giving a discourse to the monks, all the other monks would go to listen to it, but Badali would hang back and stay in his hut or his cottage. When there was some formal function of the Sangha, all the other monks would go, but Badali again would hold back. And whenever Badali knew that the Buddha would be in a particular place at a particular time, he would always avoid going to that place because he was so embarrassed. Okay, then towards the end of the rains retreat, a number of the monks were making up a new robe for the Buddha, so that when the rains period was finished and then the Buddha would set out on his tour again, he would have a new robe. And so this time Venerable Badali came out, probably a little hesitant, a little shy to see anybody, but he came out and he met with these other bhikkhus. And then these bhikkhus told him that when this robe has been made up for the Blessed One, then when the rainy season is over, the Buddha is going to set out wandering again. Then you might miss your chance to apologize to the Buddha. And so they say to him, please, friend Badali, give proper attention to your statement. Don't let it become more difficult for you later on. They probably knew that if Badali did not reconcile himself to the Buddha, then the Buddha left, then Badali might have become overcome by remorse for his behavior, but he wouldn't be able to meet the Buddha and apologize to him. And so now Badali has recognized his fault, his offense in refusing to accept the Buddha's advice. So now he goes to the Buddha and he offers an apology. And here the text uses a pretty standard formula. Whenever anybody commits a transgression or an offense against the Buddha, then when they come to him, the text always phrases it in exactly the same, in more or less the same words. So here he says, Bhante, Venerable Sir, the transgression overcame me. I like the Pali words better. Yeah, I was so foolish, so deluded, so unskillful that when a training precept was being made known by the Buddha, the Blessed One, I openly declared in the midst of the whole Sangha that I was unwilling to undertake the training. And now he says, may the Blessed One forgive me for my transgression, which I have now recognized as such, for the sake of restraint in the future. By saying for the sake of restraint in the future, he declares that he's going to undertake the training rule laid down by the Buddha. Now he will follow that training rule. But the Buddha doesn't let him get off so easily. But he wants him to recognize the consequences of his refusal. So first he simply repeats what Badali has said, that surely a transgression overcame you, and that you were so foolish, so deluded, so unskillful, that when a training precept was being made known by me, you publicly declared in the midst of the Sangha that you were unwilling to undertake the training. And then the Buddha points out some of the consequences that Badali himself was not aware of. First, well, this he would have been aware of, that the Buddha himself knows that Badali is one who has refused to accept the training laid down by the Buddha. Then all of these monks who are living together in this residence at Savatthi also know that Badali is one who is rebelling against the training. Then all of the bhikkhunis, the nuns who are residing in Savatthi, are aware that Badali has refused to accept the training. Not only the monks and nuns, but even the lay followers, the male and female lay followers, know that Badali is refusing to accept the training. Somehow that word would have spread out to the lay community. And also, in Rajagaha, there would have been wandering ascetics of different sects who were living in, who had settled in Savatthi for the rains. And somehow the word would have spread out to them too, that this disciple of the recluse Gotama, the monk named Badali, is one who has refused to undertake the training in the Buddha's dispensation. And so now Badali is being informed that it's sort of like public knowledge that he's the black sheep in the community because of his refusal to accept the training. And so now maybe Badali has become more aware of his fault in refusing to accept the training. And so he repeats his apology and asks for the Buddha to forgive him. And again, the Buddha repeats this, but he's still not going to let him get off so easily. In fact, we see the Buddha in a rather stern, almost uncompromising mood here. Now he's going to show Badali how a monk who is properly undertaking the training would behave. So he says, suppose there were a monk who is one liberated in both ways. Liberated in both ways means that this monk is an arhant who has been liberated in mind through gaining mastery of all of the stages of samadhi, of deep concentration. And he's liberated by wisdom, by destroying all of the defilements through wisdom. And so if the Buddha were to say to such a monk, they were walking along a muddy road, muddy path, and he said, come, monk, lie down in the mud and let your body be a plank for me to walk across the mud. So would this monk walk across himself, or would he dispose his body otherwise? Or would he say no? Then Badali says, no, venerable sir. And this passage, it's a little discomforting, but the commentary points out that the Buddha himself would never, in fact, make such a demand of any of his disciples. But he's not saying that this is something that he would actually do, but he's rather trying to show just an extreme case, take an extreme case, in order to show that a monk who has true sadha, true confidence in the Buddha, and truly wants to undertake the training, would follow the Buddha's word, whatever it is. And sometimes one might see a conflict between this and the advice that the Buddha gives in the famous Kalama Sutta. Don't follow anything that the teacher says just because he's impressive, but investigate for yourself, consider for yourself, and reflect, is this wholesome, is this beneficial, or is this harmful and unbeneficial? And so if somebody were to give you, even the Buddha were to give a command, lie down in the mud and be a plank for me, then one would think, what's happened to this great teacher? It seems he's being carried away by a kind of guru egotism. And so one might, in that case, have quite valid grounds for not following the Buddha's instructions, since that would be an extreme kind of demand for a teacher to make of a disciple. But here the Buddha is just taking this extreme case as a hypothesis to show how a monk who's really understood the Dhamma would behave. And I have to say, I don't quite like the simile myself. Especially in our modern age, it doesn't quite go down so well. Okay, suppose a monk here who is one liberated by wisdom. Again, this is an arhant who doesn't have that mastery of samadhi, but through wisdom he's completely destroyed all of the defilements. Then we have other classes of noble disciples. We've explained them in an earlier class, so we don't have to go over them again. But in each case, if the Buddha asked him to lie down and be a plank, the monk would not refuse, but would do so. And then the Buddha asks Badali, and here he seems to really be hammering it into Badali. He says, on that occasion, were you one liberated in both ways, liberated by wisdom, or you any other of these types of noble disciples? And the Dali says, no, venerable sir. Then the Buddha says, again, this seems rather stern and strict. On that occasion, weren't you an empty, hollow wrongdoer? Again, poor Badali is really getting it hammered into him. All he can do is repeat his word of apology and then ask the Buddha to forgive him. Now he's asked the third time. Okay, this time the Buddha says, truly a transgression overcame you, and so on. But now the Buddha is ready to accept it and says, since you see your transgression as such and make amends in accordance with the Dhamma, that is by offering an apology, we forgive you. And he says, for it is growth in the Noble One's discipline when one sees one's transgression as such and makes amends in accordance with the Dhamma by undertaking restraint for the future. And so this is an important statement that the Buddha is saying, in effect, that he can't expect all of his disciples to be perfect. Many times we will commit transgressions, but as long as we recognize them as such and then make a determination to practice in the proper way in the future, then one can emerge from one's transgressions. Okay, now the Buddha is going to show some other consequences of not fulfilling the training in his dispensation, that is, in his teaching. He says, suppose we have some monk who is not fulfilling the training, and then he goes to a secluded place wanting to attain what's called a superhuman state, that is, some state of excellent knowledge and vision, worthy of the noble ones. And then when he goes there, he withdraws. The teacher, that's the Buddha, criticizes him. His fellow monks criticize him. Even the devas recognize that he's committed a transgression and criticize him. And then also he feels a guilty conscience, and so he censures himself. And so in this way, the Buddha says, he asks the question, or the Buddha says, he realizes, he doesn't realize any superhuman state, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. And why is that? That is how it is with one who does not fulfill the training in the teacher's dispensation. And this raises in my mind the question, is it just the fact that, say, Badali would have been taking food in the afternoon and evening that is preventing him from reaching some higher attainment? It seems to me that that can't be the explanation, because in later history of Buddhism and other forms of Buddhism, East Asian Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, the rule about not eating after noon has not been followed so strictly. And yet in those traditions, there have been meditators who have reached high levels of samadhi and of perhaps of realization through wisdom. So I think it's not the fact of eating in the afternoon or evening that is the obstacle to the attainment, but the fact that when the Buddha himself has laid down a training rule in one's own presence, then one is refusing to accept that training. And so I think it's the state of mind which is rebelling against the training rule that is creating the obstacle, and not the physical act of eating in the afternoon and evening. Uh, Okay, and then the Buddha takes, in paragraph 15, he takes the converse case of a monk who does fulfill the training in the dispensation. And then he goes off into seclusion, and then he's not criticized by the Buddha, by fellow monks, or by himself. And so in this way, he'll have a clear conscience. He will not have any kind of disturbance in mind. And in that way, he'll be able to achieve some superhuman state, some distinction and knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. And then the Buddha goes on to describe that as the attainment of the four jhanas, then the three higher knowledges, the recollection of past lives, the divine eye, and then the liberation of the mind from the taints, from the asavas. And so then, in paragraph 22, now Badali asks some questions. These are questions, again, that have to do with disciplinary matters in the life of the Sangha. First, Badali asks, why is it that sometimes they take action against some monk by repeatedly admonishing him? And why is it that they do not take such action against some monk by repeatedly admonishing him? Okay, now the Buddha will mention various cases. First, there's a case of a monk who constantly commits transgressions, who breaks many of the rules, and then when other monks try to correct him or criticize him, instead of admitting his fault and saying that he's going to change his behavior, he will prevaricate, he'll tell lies to try to cover himself up, saying that I didn't behave that way. Or he'll try to divert the subject of discussion by talking about some other matter. Sometimes he'll turn the criticism around by criticizing the monks who are trying to correct him. So if others are criticizing him for committing some offense, instead of admitting it and saying, yes, I'll try to change my ways, he'll say, well, I saw you doing the same thing, so you shouldn't be criticizing me. And then he'll try to get everybody to bear down on that other monk. Then he'll show disturbance, hatred, bitterness, and he doesn't comply with the advice that he's being given by the Sangha. And so then when the Sangha has to pass some penalty on that monk, they will try to impose a strong penalty against him. And they won't allow the case to be settled very quickly. But then in the opposite case, we might have a monk who's committed many offenses and regularly transgresses against the rules. But when he's corrected by the monks, then he doesn't try to defend himself, he doesn't try to evade the criticism, but he accepts the advice of the Sangha and changes his behavior. And in this case, the monks will decide to settle the litigation against him quickly, since he shows himself willing to change. Okay, the next two cases are also decided on the same principle. Okay, but now in paragraph 27, we come to a case of a monk, they say, who's progressing by a measure of faith and love, or faith and devotion. And now this monk might be one who is violating certain rules, transgressing regularly, and yet the monks might decide that this monk is not, maybe he's not very intelligent, not very earnest in his effort to practice. He's not one who's endowed with good faculties, but he has this genuine faith and devotion. And so they hesitate to take any kind of strong disciplinary action against him from fear that if they admonish him strongly, criticize him harshly, then he might lose his faith and devotion and fall away from the monastic life. And the Buddha compares this to a man who has only one eye, and so his friends and companions and his relatives would always be very careful never to do any kind of work in his presence that might pose a risk to his sight. Like they won't do any kind of carpentry or metalwork in his presence, since if a piece of metal were to fly up and strike his eye, the good eye, it might blind him. And so they're very, very deeply concerned to preserve his sight. And so in the same way, sometimes the monks will not criticize and not condemn a monk whose behavior is irregular, but because they want to preserve his faith and devotion, they don't take strong action against him. Okay, then Badali asks another question. This is an interesting question because it shows that the idea of the decline of the sasana, the decline of Buddhism, had already started during the Buddha's own lifetime. Like usually now we think this is the age when the true Dhamma is declining and almost disappearing, but we think during the Buddha's time it must have been prosperous and flourishing. But even during the Buddha's time, people were thinking in the early days it used to be wonderful, but now, even though we have many, many monks practicing very earnestly, but they're not attaining the high attainments that the monks were able to attain in the early days. So he asks, what is the cause, what is the reason why previously there were fewer training rules, yet more monks became established in final knowledge? And why is it now there are more training rules, yet fewer monks become established in final knowledge? It's said that during, I think, the first 20 years of the Buddha's teaching career, he didn't lay down any fixed precepts or training rules, since during that period, the Buddha would just have to give some suggestion and everybody would follow it. It was only after 20 years that monks started deviating from the proper conduct of the monks. Then the Buddha started laying down training rules. Then each time monks behaved improperly, the Buddha would have to lay down another training rule and another one, till over time there accumulated about more than 150 rules. And yet in the early period of the Buddha's teaching, it said there were monks who achieved very quickly, they would reach the highest attainments. Sometimes the Buddha would just give a discourse, and at the end of the discourse, 20, 30, 40, 50 monks would either attain stream entry or even attain arhatship. But now, in this dark period when the Buddha might be 60, 70 years old, there are many training rules, but fewer monks are attaining. And then the Buddha says, this is how it is when beings are deteriorating and the true Dhamma is disappearing. That's in the last years of the Buddha's life. Then there are more training rules and fewer monks become established in final knowledge. Then the Buddha says, now he explains the conditions under which he lays down these training rules. He says, the teacher, that is himself, I do not make known a training rule for disciples until certain things that are the basis for the taints, that's for the defilements, become manifest here in the Sangha. But when those things that are the basis for the taints, basis for the defilements, start to appear in the Sangha, then I lay down the training rules. And then the Buddha explains what are the things that create this basis for the taints, the conditions that function as a groundwork for these defilements to start to arise. He says the things that are the basis for the taints do not appear in the Sangha until the Sangha has reached greatness. That is, till it starts growing in size, till one has many monks, many nuns. But it's when the Sangha has reached greatness, when the size of the order increases, that those things that are the basis for taints appear. Then he has to lay down the training rule in order to protect his monastic followers from those things. Another condition for the taints to appear is when the Sangha has reached the acme of worldly gain. See, what happens is that when the Sangha gets a good reputation, becomes known as a field of merit, then people want to earn merit, and so they make offerings to the Sangha. And then these offerings become objects of craving and attachment. So in the very early days, before the Sangha is well known, when the Buddha and the monks are still somewhat obscure, then they're content to live very simply. They just go on their begging rounds and collect what food they're offered, and they live on that for the day. They can live in very simple huts. They make up their own robes from pieces of discarded cloth, usually taken from corpses in the cremation ground, which they sew themselves. But when the Sangha becomes well known, then people build large monasteries with comfortable dwelling places. They bring them very delicious food. And nowadays they give, I hear this in Thailand, they give television set, stereo CD players, all types of electronic equipment, because they think it's meritorious for them. And so the monks get all of this cars. And so even if in one monastery, if people give a Mercedes-Benz, and then to the next monastery they donate Toyota or a Korean car, what is it called?
Hyundai.
Then the ones who get the Toyota or the Hyundai look at the monastery that gets the Mercedes-Benz, and then they start complaining to their followers, why do we have to ride about in a Toyota when those monks are riding around in a Mercedes? Take back this Toyota, get us a Mercedes so we can be just as good as them. Okay, so when they reached worldly gain, when they become famous, then they become attached to their fame, name and fame, and then that becomes a basis for taints. When they get great learning and long-standing renown. Okay, so all of these things, the Buddha says, have now appeared in the Sangha. And so he's had to lay down these training rules in order to protect the monks and the nuns from the arising of the taints or defilements. Okay, now the Buddha refers to a discourse that he must have given quite a long time ago, because he says there were a few of you. That means that there must have been only a small sangha at that time when I taught the simile of the young thoroughbred colt. Then he asks Badali whether he remembers that. And Badali says, no, I don't. And then he asks, what is the reason that you don't remember that? And he says, I have long been one who did not fulfill the training in the teacher's dispensation. And then the Buddha says, again, he's really hammering it into this poor monk. That's not the only reason. But he says, but rather by encompassing your mind with my mind, that is, by directly reading your mind at that time, I realize that when I'm teaching the Dhamma, this foolish man, Badali, doesn't pay attention. He doesn't engage it with all of his mind and does not listen to it with eager ears. That's a stock passage which describes the way a disciple should listen to the Dhamma. One should listen by paying close attention to it, by applying one's whole mind to it, and one listens by bending the ears to pick up every word of the discourse. But it seems this Badali, probably because he was worried about food, so he might have been thinking, while the Buddha is speaking, what what am I going to have for lunch today? What am I going to have for dinner tonight? Since he's taking food in the evening. So he's not paying attention to the discourse. But now the Buddha says, I will repeat for you that discourse. Listen and pay close attention to what I say. Then the Buddha explains how a skillful horse trainer trains a thoroughbred horse, a thoroughbred colt. And he has to train him gradually, step by step. So first, this horse, because he's never been trained before, he's wild and rebellious. So the horse trainer first has to make him get used to wearing the bit. Okay, then when he gets used to wearing the bit, he'll display some contortion, wreathing, and vacillation. But through constant repetition and gradual practice, he becomes peaceful in that action. Now, in the Pali, this the word that's translated here as becomes peaceful is parinibbayati. Parinibbayati. I'll write that. See, the word parinibbayati means, literally it means extinguishing or going out, and it's applied to the going out of a fire. That was the original usage. But then it came on to take the sense of becoming peaceful in something. So when a wild horse settles down and loses his rebelliousness, it's said that the horse parinibbayati. And And then when he completely settles down, then it's said that the horse parinibbuto, which means in relation to a fire, it would mean becoming extinct. But the way the Buddhist texts usually use the word parinibbuto, it means that one has completely attained nibbana. And so the expression used in relation to horse training would be that we could translate it that the horse attains nibbana with respect to that particular action in which he's being trained. And so the horse trainer trains the horse step by step in successively more difficult and more demanding tasks. First, the colt has to get used to wearing the bit. Then he has to get used to wearing the harness. Then the horse trainer has to teach the horse how to keep in step, then run in a circle, then how to prance, how to gallop, how to charge, until when that horse is completely trained, then he has what is called the kingly qualities, the kingly heritage, the highest speed, the highest fleetness, and the highest gentleness. And at each stage, when the horse is being trained, he displays some contortion, wreathing, and vacillation. That means he's fighting against the training, refusing to accept it. But the horse trainer remains patient, constantly tries to get the horse to perform that action, and over time, through constant repetition and gradual practice, the horse becomes skilled in those particular tasks. He becomes parinibbuto, he attains nibbana with respect to those tasks. And then when he's gone through the whole training, and the Buddha mentions 10 stages of training, then he becomes worthy of a king in the king's service and one of the factors of a king. The king must have a well-trained thoroughbred horse. So the practice and of the training in the Buddhist teaching is also a step-by-step practice in which one begins with simpler practices, then one takes up more difficult practices, until one takes up the most difficult practices. And each time one masters an earlier practice, that forms a stage or a foundation for the next practice. And so there comes about a gradual mastery of the training through constant repetition and through gradual practice. And then the Buddha completes the simile. He says that just as the thoroughbred horse masters these 10 tasks and then he becomes worthy of a king, so he says that a monk who possesses 10 qualities is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of salutation, an unsurpassed field of merit for the world. It's the standard description that the Buddha uses for the Sangha, but the ones within the Sangha who truly deserve that description are those who possess these 10 qualities. And what are these 10 qualities? That is, the monk has to possess the right view of one beyond training. That's one who's completed the training. That would be the right view of an arahant. Then the right intention, the right speech, right action, right livelihood of one beyond training, of one who's mastered the whole training, the right effort, the right mindfulness, and right concentration of one beyond training. Okay, those are all the eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. But here, they're not parts of a path anymore, because now they are the qualities of one who has completed the path, who has fulfilled the whole path. And because he's completed the whole path beyond these eight factors, he possesses two more. One is the right knowledge of one beyond training. That is, he's completed, he's brought the knowledge of insight to its final fulfillment. So now he has perfect, complete understanding of the whole Dhamma of the Buddha. And through that right understanding, he possesses right liberation of one beyond training. And then the Buddha says, this is the one who is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, an unsurpassed field of merit for the world. Okay, and that is the end of the sutta. Okay, if there's any questions, please feel welcome to ask. No questions. It's not really a very difficult sutta. Okay, next, if there's no questions, then we just end. Okay, next Tuesday, I'll take sutta number, I think it's 104. But I won't take the whole sutta because parts of it are not really of so much interest to a general reader. I'll skip over the passage going from paragraph 12 to through paragraph 20. That's a rather complex section dealing with details of monastic discipline. But rather, I'll deal with just really the beginning few paragraphs of the sutta, especially on the six roots of disputes, and then the six principles of harmony and respect. Okay, then we end by sharing the merits. Okay, we share the merits with the devas, the nagas, the buddhas, asking them to rejoice in these merits, and to protect the world, to protect the Buddha's teaching, to protect ourselves and others. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanang Akasata Chibumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mang Parang Etavatacha Amhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabbe Deva Anumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya Etavatacha Amhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabbe Bhutanumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya